Hi, good evening. My name's Claire Hemmings. I'm a professor of feminist theory at the Gender Institute here at LSE. And it's my great pleasure this evening to introduce Sonia Correa, who is giving her first of two Leverhulme lectures this evening. I'll introduce Sonia in a moment, and I just wanted to give you a sense of the order of the evening, which is that I'll speak for a few minutes. I'll pass over to Sonia. I'll collect questions, nice, succinct, short, and to-the-point questions, and then I'll... Sonia will engage you in discussion, and then we'll have a drink outside at the reception to celebrate Sonia's presence and participation in LSE this term. If we hear a klaxon, we have to wait and hear what kind of klaxon it is as to whether we leave immediately or whether we listen for further instructions. This is a new regulation I've just seen. So Sonia Correa is visiting Leverhulme Professor at the Gender Institute and one of the leading developers of sexual rights in a global frame. As a practitioner and consultant whose published work is central to academic developments in the field, Sonia is uniquely placed to help us attend to the urgent questions posed by sexual rights in a contemporary global context. Sonia's the co-chair and executive coordinator of Sexuality Policy Watch, and she was also the research coordinator for DAWN, which many of you will have encountered, which is the Development Alternatives with Women for a New Era. She's the author or co-author of 8 books, including Interlinking Policy, Politics and Women's Reproductive Rights, Sexuality, Health and Human Rights with Richard Parker and Rosalind Pachetsky, Development with a Body with Andrea Cornwall and Susie Jolly, Sexuality in Politics, Regional Dialogues from the Global South, Volumes 1 and 2, very recently, which is part of a new development of web-based publication on dialogues around sexual rights in global perspective. Which, I mean, when you think about the fact that Sonia doesn't work as a full-time academic, but is writing in a context of having full-time and more work elsewhere in terms of advocacy and development of policy, that's extraordinary to my mind. Many people spend full-time academic lives publishing and thinking less extensively and with less kinds of interlocutors. We invited Sonia to join us at the Gender Institute this year and next to help us bring together and expand several strands of our own research and teaching on sexual rights. Sonia is one of the few intellectuals and practitioners whose work brings theory and practice within sexuality studies and development studies together as both a primary aim as well as outcome of her work. Such difficulties in developing an interdisciplinary discussion about sexual rights arises in part because of the distinct disciplinary differences between these areas. So while both areas draw on the social sciences, development studies, as many of you will know, has a stronger economic and policy focus, while sexuality studies, and particularly queer studies, draws more on cultural theory and literary and historical humanities. In part two, it's because, while both areas share concerns with sexual rights, development studies is more likely to prioritise practice. Sexuality studies is at least as likely to concentrate on epistemological and cultural concerns, including those that track the remains, in heavy inverted commas, of colonial power relations in development practice and economic inequality. So these conversation gaps are evident when you try to think about sexual rights through queer theory, which draws most explicitly on cultural theory and philosophy, and read reproductive health perspectives on sexual rights, for example, through a queer lens. So we're as likely across these disciplinary locations to look at each other bewildered as we are to use such productive differences as the starting point for combined research and teaching switching agendas. And yet, of course, we also know that this kind of dialogue is incredibly important and urgent for addressing the key issues raised by LGBT rights, reproductive rights and health, questions of the mobilisation of gay, lesbian and bisexual identities as markers of modernity at the border and so on. And it's precisely Sonia's work at the intersections between these disciplinary and political impasses that is so important in being able to break a deadlock and develop language for a new conversation that has at its heart these kinds of... has at its heart these deadlocks and has as an aim the importance of breaking those in order to develop a proper conversation about how to think about sexuality globally. So already while Sonia's been here, she's been engaging in a range of conversations across both the Gender Institute, LSE, and nationally with people trying also to think about these questions, as well as, of course, with lots of students from the Gender Institute and beyond. And it's this question of dialogue across the differences that make up the paradox of sexual rights that is the subject of Sonia's talk this evening in the first Leverhulme lecture. So the lecture's called Thinking Sexualities, Globalities and the Politics of Rights from an Interdisciplinary Perspective. Please join me in welcoming Sonia to the LSE.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
Well, good night. I thank you everybody for being here today. And I want to begin by publicly expressing my gratitude to the Leverhulme Trust for the privileged opportunity of this professorship at the Gender Institute of the London School of Economics, and in particular to Professors Claire Hemmings and Naila Kabir, who have generously invited me to be here in these two periods of 3 months, this year and next year. I also want to thank Hazel Johnston and Kate Stewart for their amazingly effective technical support that allow me to arrive in time in London to be properly housed and taken care of, and also the very friendly reception and care that I have received from professors and students at the Gender Institute. And I want to a particular thank to Luisa Ciori, because she has assisted me in preparing the PowerPoint, and she is assisting me in presenting the PowerPoint now. I also need to thank my dear friends Mauro Cabral, Alejandra Sardá and Fernando Helio, because they have provided me with key information, last moment key information and image that you're going to see in the PowerPoint. As you know, I speak as a Brazilian, meaning I speak as a Latin American, but also from a standpoint, as Claire has already generously talked about my trajectory, it's a standpoint constructed through many years of transnational and intersectional work in gender, sexuality, and human rights. Part of this work has been done in international policy sites, particularly the UN, but not exclusively. This has also implied many, many horizontal exchanges, particularly across the South, the global South. Today, I will once again revisit this interstate policy arenas that I have been involved with and written about. After thinking a little bit, I took this route not because I view the scenes as the only and more important place to be looked at when you're talking about sexuality, gender, and human rights. There are many other critical and eventually much, much more colorful and pleasant places to be visited. But I made this option because each time I revisit these scenarios, something previously uncharted erupts. It is a bit like the archaeologists going and returning to the same site in search of lost remnants that you have not found the first time. But sometimes I think it looks a little bit like the criminal getting back to the crime scene. No? In this new incursion, I'm pulling threads of my previous work. People that have read me will identify that. But I'm trying to weave them with ideas and debates that I have been exposed since I arrived at the Gender Institute in September. And in this, I'll say some preliminary, very preliminary articulations between what happens in this crossroads of gender, sexuality, and human rights, and the present challenges of democratic, or if you want, undemocratic politics. The structure of my talk, I'm not going to get listed because you've seen the transnational turn, power captures, indispensability of human rights. I'm going to look into specific cases and we'll try to address the question of democratic politics at the end. Before moving forward, I want to make two notes. The first is that I will be mostly using the formula genders and sexualities that we have crafted in a paper with Richard Parker and Brian Richard Davis that some of the PhD students have read as a semantic strategy to denote the disjunction and linkage between gender and sexuality as well the plasticity and variability. I have made this choice because I'm not persuaded that the idea of queering rights or queer rights politics describes and analyzes properly the type of processes that I'll be talking about. Although there are moments, there are queer moments, and there are this queer theory circulating there, but I don't think it's a proper description. Huh? So this is tentative, but let's see. The second is that I cannot not say a few words about the U.S. elections. Trump caught me midway in preparation for this lecture and made me stop and ask myself if the ideas I was ruminating about still make any sense. Even under ordinary conditions, if ever they exist, past and present U.S. politics cannot be circumvented when we examine the linkages between genders, sexualities, and human rights. This is much more obviously the case when we are in a situation where the masculinist, racist, sexist, xenophobic, anti-queer, right-wing ideologies that have colonized the U.S. electoral process are on the verge of being translated into statecraft. The U.S. election results have also made flagrant the nefarious effects of economic inequalities and of the widening fractures between the politics of recognition and politics of redistribution. As we know, the word fascism is being written not anymore on the walls of the cities, but in op-ed articles in the mainstream press. The potential effects of Trump's victory with regards to the continuation and expansion of global wars is not to be glossed over. But I think that when assessed from a bottom-up transnational perspective, the most important thing, at least from the point of view of my discussion today, is that post-Trump U.S. politics is not to be seen as an exception, but as a new link in a very disturbing chain that I'm placing, of which the beginning I'm placing in the demise of the Arab Spring in 2013, followed by India, Hungary, Poland, the Brazilian coup, the Philippines, Brexit, Turkey, the almost failed peace process in Colombia, and not less Nicaragua, which is a tiny country that nobody speaks much about, but with which I have a very long political and friendly relation. We must ask what may be the implications of this somber landscape for democratic politics and within democratic politics, the intersectional politics of genders, sexualities, and human rights. In the immediate reaction to Trump, North American feminists and queer thinkers have called for more clarity on what went wrong, and most principally have emphasized resistance. I want to keep this message alive at the back of our minds as I continue my talk. As we know, the politics of gender, sexuality, and human rights did not begin a few decades ago. It is a vast realm inhabited by multiple temporalities, most principally by the pivotal location of rights, gender, and sexuality in the very formation of the modern nation-state and its multiple paradoxes. Capitalism, inequality, biopolitics, and the colonial at its center. But it's also haunted by those events and trends that were at play between the end of the Second World War and the fall of the walls in 1989. While we have to keep in touch with these specters of other times, we also need to recognize that in the course of the last 25 years, the language of gender, sexuality, and rights escaped from the nation-state boundaries and began to circulate horizontally, but also have been transported to the global circuits of interstate politics and norm setting. Starting with women's rights debates in the 70s and followed by processes related to the HIV epidemics in the 90s, this transnational turn drastically intensified after 1989, when international human rights politics was revitalized and the UN sponsored a series of conferences on social issues ranging from children's rights to racism, racial discrimination, and xenophobia. Feminists and other voices and bodies entered the sites which were not immune to the complex and contradictory trends and forces sweeping the world beyond the rooms of the UN. The unleashed forces of globalization, neoliberalism, shifting patterns of inequality, intensified migration, the sad return of the religious, U.S. hegemony, localized conflicts, militarized humanitarian interventions, and subsequently the unending war on terror and its tragic ramifications. But also the parallel and wide, deep cultural and political alterations, as well recreations of gender and sexuality orders, of which we can talk much. The UN gender and sexuality saga that followed was very vertiginous, very rapid. In 1993, sexual violence was defined as a human rights issue in Vienna, in the Vienna Conference of Human Rights, and the terms gender and reproductive and sexual rights entered the preparatory document for the Cairo Conference on Population and Development. In 1995, in Beijing, a paragraph on women's sexual rights was approved. In 2003, Brazil, my country, presented a resolution on sexual orientation and human rights at the Human Rights Commission that do not exist anymore. The resolution failed, and there's a long story about that. In 2006, a group of activists and experts elaborated outside of the UN formal arenas the Yogyakarta Principles for the Application of Human Rights in Relation to Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity. It's 10 years right now. Yogyakarta was in the beginning of November of 2006. By then, the UN member states were using those terms regularly in their in declarations, in joint declarations, in individual declarations. And this year, in June, the Human Rights Council approved the creation of a post of an independent expert on human rights, sexual orientation, and gender identity. A parallel trail can be traced from the Vienna definition on sexual violence, comprising a series of resolutions and protocols on gender and conflict situations, but also the domain of trafficking in persons. These were not smooth bureaucratic conversations. These were harsh political, geopolitical, and biopolitical disputes. They were about claiming rights of recognition and redistribution, but also about using rights as a wedge to pry open biopolitical logics, to contest population policies, instrumentalization of women's bodies for fertility control, but also population policies that existed at that point that were about compulsory motherhood. We forgot about that. the biomedical hegemony presiding over the response to HIV/AIDS. In doing so, this disputes the strip bare the centrality of heteronormativity, procreation, and the pivotal role of sex in economic, demographic, health, and governance rationales. They also meant tense North-South disputes on aid, structural adjustment, poverty, migration, patterns of production and consumption, sustainability. And not less importantly, they were transected by an intense geopolitics and biopolitics of the religious. In entering the cycle of upward transnationalization, we have moved from a critical distance in relation to statecraft and the troubled places where norms are generated. Crossing this red line was risky, but we have not been dragged there by domineering external power fluxes. We have made this risky step because rights language pertain to the vocabulary of anti-authoritarian, post-dictatorship, counter-hegemonic struggles that in which we have been engaged in many places around the world, across Latin America, but also the Philippines, South Africa, Eastern Europe. And it's worth reminding that in many of the settings, the resource to rights language had a much more long history. The Zui I'm speaking of was plural in locational, racial, ethnic, regional, and sexual orientation and political standpoint terms, even when this amplitude can always be subject to interrogation. We engaged with state grammars, but also assembled and protested. Inside the UN, many times, I searched for a photograph of a hunger strike that feminists from the Caribbean organized in the Summit for Social Development in Copenhagen in 1995. They were sitting on the floor and were not eating for 5 days, just drinking water. At the same time, these internal UN debates were not disconnected from the parallel street politics, contesting WHO, contesting Bretton Woods Institution in Genoa, Seattle, those names that somehow disappeared from the memory. This was not top-down sisterhood, but a politics of friendship without which resorting to Wendy Brown's landmark piece on the paradox of rights, we would not have been able to navigate these paradoxes. And the effects of this navigation could not be paradoxical. On the luminous side, the language it generated would be dispersed and interweaving with struggles underway at local levels have distillated process of translation to what Boaventura dos Santos, the Portuguese sociologist, names as emancipatory common sense imaginations. This can be measured, perhaps better, by the reactive politics that this dispersion propelled. The attack on gender ideology that today spreads negative effects on gender and sexual politics and politics itself across the world was invented in the preparations for Beijing. In March 1995, gender language was attacked in a pamphlet distributed to southern country delegations by the U.S. religious rights, which distorted a paper by Anna Fausto Sterling on the intersex gender continuum. If you want to see the story, how this moved from the UN and went to the governmentality of the Vatican a few years later, is a very interesting story with the Opus Dei in the middle. In this outward movement, the immediate critical reactions to and reinterpretation of the Beijing paragraph on women's sexual rights, which was very good in its first phrase, but very, very heteronormative and conventional in its second phrase, is very notable because this process went against the grain of differentiation and exclusion that is always generated in procedures of recognition. Instead of being caught into women's sexual rights, the heteronormative and respectability imprints of the paragraph were interrogated and the text was re-edited to read the right of all persons to exercise their sexuality free from coercion, discrimination, and violence. by there creating a rights place potentially inhabitable by many others than just married women, that where this started. This dispersion evolved in articulation with the amplification of reproductive rights claims and particularly abortion. The Yogyakarta principles was definitely the next stage. The document directly contrasts the gender binary epistemology of human rights, the unspoken requirement that bodies must be male or female for persons to be recognized as humans. The text addresses violations of rights related to sexual orientation and gender identity without ever referring to the anatomy, gender, or sexual identity of those affected persons. It was spontaneously translated into many languages other than the six official UN tongues that was predicted in the project of Yogyakarta that they would be translated. And I'm always fascinated by Japan, where the text was originally translated in popular vernacular Japanese before being later retranscribed in scholarly dialect. It was the other way around of what happens usually with norms. But by the late 2000s, however, the effects of the war on terror and continued unleashed economic forces were glaring. States of emergency had proliferated, the racialized logics of securitization around Islamophobia intensified, and the dogmatic politics of religion continued unabated. And the world was heading towards the 2008 financial crisis. When writing at that point in time with Ross Pachevsky and Richard Parker, we assessed the post-sexual rights landscape using Derrida's framework, which speaks to the irresolvable tension between the indispensability and the insufficiency of rights. While valuing the outcomes of the 1990s and early 2000s, we also underline human rights insufficiencies, their potentially normalizing grids, victimization in prints, the exclusionary outcomes of recognition procedures, the ineffectuality of human rights in the proliferating zones of emergency. We emphasize the nodal place of dogmatic religious politics, but also stress that the patterns of gender and sexuality disciplining are to be searched always across the secular religious divide. We have also called for differentiating religious script and practice and making visible the polyvocality of religious communities in relation to these matters. These considerations, in my view, have not lost their validity. However, at that point in time, we have not been able to fully apprehend how fast the undercurrents of power intensification, the grids of governmentality, were dragging sexual rights towards the grinding mills of identity machines run by states and market logics, and to the vortex of post-colonial geopolitics. Not long after the book was published, the open language of Yogyakarta began to narrow down into soggy. Sexual orientation, SO, was standing for gays and lesbians, and GI for trans persons. At the same time, gender and sexual violence became enmeshed with exploitation and dragged towards the logics of salvationism and securitization. Rights that had been newly invented became alibis for military intervention, aid conditionality, rescue operations, and closure of borders. We had entered the era of homonationalism, and to use Paul Amar's concept of post-human gender and sexuality figures that are out there and must be protected and savaged, including using human rights. At the extremities, the landscape does not seem less troubling. If it is assessed through the charting of national and local law reforms that converge with or are infused by the effects of the work performed at transnational level, the signs appear to be auspicious. Lots of good laws in many different places. But however, when these legal changes are located in the wider and shifting landscape of statecraft, religious politics, market forces, class, race, gender, and sexuality politics and cultures, another picture emerges. in Latin America, for example, viewed as the most successful story of soggy rights south of the equator, gender and sexual politics has been trapped for some time in a maze of schizophrenic signs emanating from states, which speak a new human rights language but fail to ensure the promises projected by these rights. This incoherence is directly related to the neoliberal erosion of state capacity and increased inequalities is not just a peculiar feature of Latin America, it's to be found everywhere. In addition, in many places, state sexual rights' expressive symbolic gestures contrast with the lack of rights infrastructure. And I'm going to speak about Brazil, where we are now using the term Homo Nacionalismo a Brasileira, Homo Nacionalismo in the Brazilian mode, to talk about the abyss between the much applauded international display of support to LGBT rights by the Brazilian state and the perennially unresolved tragedy of LGBT and most principally trans people murders, which cannot be analyzed in isolation from wider and deeper partners of structural violence. We have in Brazil the stratospheric figure of 60,000 homicides per year, of which more than 80% are never investigated in some places. It is the case of the state where I live, Rio de Janeiro. Now, less important are the multiple bifurcations in respect to how states, but also social movements struggling around these rights, have been doing this work or delivering the rights. The rights of recognition prevailing over social and economic rights. LGBT rights prevailing over abortion rights. Respectable rights of marriage contrasting with the criminalization of sex work. And perhaps more disturbing, the easy and wide appeal to criminal responses, criminal law responses to gender and sexuality violations in detriment to legal and other measures aimed at transforming gender and sexuality orders. The question must be raised again. Is human rights indispensable? Is human rights, gender, and sexuality indispensable? This navigation has taken us much deeper in the rough seas of the rights paradox. If we began this journey in traversing the fogs of the end of history, we are now immersed in a twilight zone where the insufficiencies of human rights are raised across the political spectrum. For some time now, mainstream thought has criticized the ineffectiveness of human rights in responding to the needs of the poorest and the most vulnerable, and I'm thinking of Martha Nussbaum here. But this now has been stretched further to interrogate the regime of international human rights law for its inability to contribute to Western-led good global governance. On the left side of the spectrum, the continuing effects of late capitalism and neoliberalism has revived early Marx view of rights as an ideological distraction that shifts our attention from the political economy. Homo nationalism and the politics of imperial justification steers the aversion of rights that dwells in many streams of queer thinking as part of the wider rejection of any form of engagement with the state. Investments in norm setting are criticized for being an outmoded expression of counter-hegemonic struggle that cannot counter the cynicism prevailing over state politics today. Not less importantly, the somber political development of the last 3 years are deep and blunt. Tomorrow, Professor Philip Alston, who was one of the first special rapporteurs to directly address violations on the basis of gender, sexual orientation, and gender identity in his reports on extrajudicial executions, will be in this room speaking about how populisms are eroding the scaffold and reach of human rights. Those of us who have long invested in this nexus are therefore challenged to engage with and respond to these critiques and these realities. We must once again ask if articulating gender, sexuality, and human rights is indispensable, and in my view, most principally, how can these ongoing efforts be more virtuously linked with the shifting and complex fabric of democratic politics and resistance underway these days? My minor contribution to this quest today will be to look at two filaments of transnational human rights work that, in my view, speak to the indispensability of human rights as well to these challenges. While I have been insisting on the political relevance of the disruptive dimension of rights, norm codification is not irrelevant. As elaborated by Judith Butler and reiterated by many of her readers, intersexual gender and sexuality, or queer democratic politics, must contest normative violence. Normative violence is not just about acts of discrimination or other effects of dominant heteronormative ideologies inscribed in the state. It must be understood as a frame of cultural intelligibility that is deeply connected to survival, defining whose lives deserve or not living. The deleterious and potentially lethal intelligibility effects of norms must be countered at the level of their absorption by the common sense, but also in the complicated realm of codification. Having this frame in mind, one critical front line that continues to deploy normative violence derives from the resilience of long-rooted biopolitics. While there is much to be said about that in terms of abortion, HIV, the persistence and revival of population control, reproductive surrogacy, AIDS, I think that the place and meaning of pathologization of trans and intersex bodies and lives that remain practically intact is an unequivocal side of struggle against the biopolitics of our times. This biomedical consumption sustained cultural frames of intelligibility that underlie the systematic violation of the rights of these persons to a life worth living. Another critical site to be looked at is, since ever, in ever, criminal law. Quite significantly, livable struggles and sharp normative interrogations are underway in these two realms, and I'm going to speak briefly about them. The intense transnational debates underway with regards to trans and intersex depathologization is connected with the wider flows of trans politics that has blossomed in the last 20 years. But they also pertain to the route that began being constructed by the Brazilian resolution in 2003. Since then, trans activism has invaded the international arenas of norm setting, not just UN arenas, but also the regional human rights systems, successively imprinting a mark in these various interstate processes. It was the presence of trans thinkers and activists in Yogyakarta that ensured that the non-binary, non-identity base premises of the document. Since then, trans human rights work has spread widely in many directions, propelling mobilizations in all regions of the planet, enhancing national reforms, and from there moving towards the contestation of hegemonic biomedical protocols. There's people in the room that can tell much more about what is going on at the ground level. It should be noted, something very important, is that this stream of gender and sexuality and human rights work cannot be easily captured by the vortex of North-South geopolitics, simply because biomedical violations of trans and intersex people cut across the equator line. It's not a problem of the South to be rescued. In that regard, it's not trivial either that the first country to approve a gender identity law that left behind the biomedical diagnostic requirement to ensure the right to gender identity was Argentina in 2012. It's not irrelevant either that this reform was firmly premised on the human right to identity that gained legal corpse in the post-dictatorship transitional justice struggle of the country. The Argentinian law inspired reforms in Denmark, Malta, Colombia, Ireland, and Norway, establishing a new standard to be followed in terms of legal recognition, gender identity recognition. The use of human rights premises to contest psychiatric protocols began with the critique of the American Psychiatric Association, DSM, and after 2012 shifted to the reform of the World Health Organization in ICD, International Classification of Disease. In this move, ICD definitions on intersexuality are also being contested, particularly in relation to the normalizing medical procedures imposed on intersex children's body, which has now been recognized as torture by the Special Rapporteur on Torture. There is much more to be said about this trajectory. In a very concise nutshell, what I want to highlight are four aspects. First of all, trans and intersex thinking and activism has prioritized the reform of the ICD exactly because it's a state-binding sphere of intervention. This is so, it's not because these activists love the state. It's because if positive results are achieved, they will disperse normative change across national boundaries in ways that will ensure access to health. It's combining politics of recognition and politics of redistribution. These international sites of struggle are organically connected with grassroots level trans and intersex politics, and a gigantic effort is being made to disseminate, update information on what is happening up there. And this politics has always a strong mark of body and presence of intersex and trans activists within the spaces where norms are being discussed, but also on the streets. The ICD reform is highly technocratic, implies a complex process of dialogue with professional associations, all of them sexologists and doctors, and with the WHO team itself. Its goal is to remove trans-specific categories from the mental and behavior disorders chapter of the ICD, transporting them to the conditions related to sexual health chapter, and to comprehensively review intersex issues under the light of human rights. While these discussions are evolving quite positively, the continued diagnostic classification of gender diversity in childhood constitutes the most contested aspect of this reform. My question in relation to this field, or this side that I have looked, is should this complex, demanding line of transnational human rights work be labeled as an outmoded, agents-based, state-oriented politics, or rather it's to be looked at and appraised as a strand of transnational, cum loco human rights work that tries to articulate the hard and risky labor of altering norms from within and a politics of presence and embodiment, both institutional places and in the streets. Then I move to criminal law as an art to be undone. This trail that I will briefly examine is less visible than transnational politics of human rights. It's a coming together of feminists, persons of non-conforming genders and sexuality, sex workers, HIV-positive people, and in some regional spaces, drug users, and human rights experts to discuss the detrimental effects of criminal laws in their areas of concern and struggle. Originally driven by the negative impact of criminal law on public health responses to HIV/AIDS, these conversations have gradually enlarged to include many other bodies and voices. From the point of view of my argument, two aspects are worth noting. The first is the intersectionality of these conversations that potentially recovers and amplifies the politics of friendship that has initially coalesced around sexual rights. But more remarkably, in my view, is that these conversations are now addressing directly the deleterious effects of resorting to criminal law to redress human rights, gender and sexuality-based violations, a policy that has become normalized in the last 10 to 15 years. Each time you have a gender and sexual violation, you resort to criminal law, particularly within feminist circles. This questioning opens the ground for a deeper and wider critique of criminal law beyond their specific effects on gender and sexualities. It illuminates how, as insightfully remarked by Akil Membebe, the colonizer right to punish has deeply contaminated the very idea of rights in post-colonial conditions. But it also illuminates the centrality of state punitive power in the regulatory architecture of our current political formations. The power and reach of criminal law spans and contracts in accordance to the power dynamics of each time. Its more recent expansion occurred during the same 25 to 30 years whose meanders I have been retracing. As neoliberal policies continue eroding welfare states, new social perception on risk and vulnerability were systematically mobilized to support the expansion of punitive power in practically all societies and measures of criminal justice. The war on drug, we should remember, preceded the war on terror for many years. In what concerns gender and sexuality, the paradox of these trends are many. The expansion of criminal law that is central to neoliberal governmentality coexists with colonial criminal laws that punish gender and sexuality conducts, which are, however, seen as a problem out there to be corrected by human rights interventions or conditionalities, and are not seen as pertaining to the wider and deeper problem of criminal law itself that exists everywhere, not just the colonial laws in the South. Criminal law sits at a crossroad where neoliberal logic encounters the biopolitics of the religious. Across Latin America, the call for criminalization of abortion coming from the conservative religious forces is interweaving with the new, with this persistent element of expanding the punitive power of the current formation. And as we have seen, unfortunately, feminist and LGBT activists have been adding water to these mills. The intensification of the state punitive power has everywhere deleterious effects, and we know in the most vulnerable and precarious groups, as illustrated by the increasing numbers of black, poor, ethnic differentiated subjects in incarceration, or as the victims of lethal police violence almost everywhere. Though very incipient, these intersectional conversations which began under a wide sexual rights umbrella may contribute to extract discussions around criminal law from the identity or issue-based cubicles in which they had been confined, and eventually open trails of connectivity and dialogue with bottom-up democratic imaginations and struggles that have been contesting the scale and impact of punitive power in many places. The road ahead is certainly treacherous and long. Yet, to quote my dear friend Scott Long, we have engaged with human rights to begin with because it provided a language for us to imagine a future worth living. Much more can and should be said with regard to disjunctions and potentially virtuous connections between the evolving politics of gender, sexuality, and human rights, and the theoretical and political urgent questions now traversing the landscape of democratic and undemocratic politics in the world. And I expect that we will be able to discuss that a little bit more today. Very briefly, before ending, I just want to underline that as I see it, possibilities are open for the articulation between the domain of gender, sexuality, and human rights and the struggles underway. Because of the histories of the past, but also because rights language is not foreign to the vocabularies that are being used in the contestations, resistance, and process underway. As I was writing this, I spent some time looking into the internet for many critical sites of struggle to check if people was or not using rights language. And people is using rights language. It may be not the codified language. It may be different from what we think is rights, but people is using. I've seen lots of activists, for example, Native Americans activists in Standing Rock, Standing Point, using right language systematic. And the same apply for the various manifestations of occupations and resistance in Brazil. But yeah, for those bridges to be consistently extended, I think that some things must change in our own realm of gender, sexuality, and human rights work, particularly at the international level. For example, we have to be more open to dissent, because what exceeds is what makes democracy democratic. In many circumstances, dissent is to remain as such instead of being forced into consensus. And I'm saying so because there have been some tensions in transnational circles about dissent in relation to agendas and topics, including the very creation of the post of independent expert. And in my view, the way this was processed, it was not as fruitful and virtuous as it could have been from a radical democratic perspective. Also very important, the regrettable outcomes of the October 2016 Colombia peace referendum has taught us that the caveats of top-down strategies to ensure gender and sexual justice cannot be any more hidden under the carpet. The attack on gender ideology that was unleashed before the voting was effective because the gains made in recent years with regard to gender, sexuality, and human rights have emanated from top-down court decisions, had not ensured or achieved the adherence of large sectors of society, which is the place that needs to be fertilized, even if this is much more hardly and slow, the grounds for gender and sexuality justice. Last but not least, I have been saying that for some time. I have not myself been able to tackle the problem as I would have liked. I think that these fields, human rights, sexuality, gender, are challenged to create space for cross-boundary and transnational conversations addressing the nodal problem of the state. Or to recapture the elaboration of the political philosopher, the feminist political philosopher Nikita Dhawan, who was herself recapturing Gayatri Spivak, of the problem of the state as pharmakon, which is at once remedy and poison. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Sonia, for an incredibly rich paper that I think raises so many key questions, both about the history and present of sexual rights and the particular contestations over public politics, democracy, and their relationship to sexuality and gender in a whole variety of ways. So I'm going to open up to the floor to ask questions for you. The preference, I think, is for people to I'll collect sort of two or three questions and then have you reply. So can I just get a sense of how many people are asking questions? Okay, so here, and then I see you. Yeah, Nadia.
Thank you so much, Sonia. That was amazing. My question is quite brief around what country do you feel has the most progressive rights with regards to sex workers' rights in terms of their protection?
Can you repeat it? I'm not hearing you.
What nation has the most progressive rights in terms of sex workers' rights and protection?
Sex workers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry, what I didn't say was if people could say their name, so it's too late, but yeah, and it's Nadia.
Robin Hannah, LSE alumnus. I wonder if you could say something about the Dilma Rousseff, who has just been, if I understand, pushed out of her position, and she was, I think, actually treated very physically abused as a, which is a tragedy, and I would consider her as an emblem of human rights in Brazil and elsewhere. But she's been Private Michael Temer, the present president, but he's not two guys. He just had a ghastly air crash, and he's given his condolences for that. But I wonder if you could say something about what you think of Dilma Rousseff and her relationship to the rights of women in Brazil.
Dilma Rousseff.
Yeah.
Dilma Rousseff, the president.
Okay. Oh, that's a very hot topic. I can say a lot about that.
Any other questions at this point? Okay, we'll come back had a chance to think. Do you want to respond to that?
Yeah. In relation to sex work, if I'm not wrong, the two places where sex workers' rights have been recognized as labor rights and efforts have been made to ensure the widest protection are New Zealand. It's very interesting. It's New Zealand and in Uruguay. The two countries in the world where we have seen very positive developments lately. In contrast, in Europe, countries that used to have relatively open regulations, state regulations in regard to sex work, are retreating back into criminalization, not of sex workers themselves, but of clients, following the model that has been established in Sweden in the late 1990s under strong, considered a feminist victory. The Swedish law of 1998 or 9 is considered a feminist victory. And this model is being transported more or less everywhere. In Brazil, there are conservative parliamentarians proposing criminalization of clients, a country that has not criminalized sex work since ever and ever. And so the situation is quite distressing. There's a new legal proposition underway in India also, where there's a very vital sex work movement exists. The legislation being proposed in India, which is makes an overlapping with trafficking law, it's highly problematic, and it's being contested by the sex work movement. So what we see is really these two islands, Uruguay and New Zealand. One is really an island, and a trend towards criminalization. Having said that, I think that one incredibly positive development of the last 10 years has been the mobilization, articulation, transnational articulation, and also a politics of presence and body of the sex works movement. I mean, this has been incredible. At the UN venues, international AIDS conferences, there's a lot of cultural work around sex work, cultural transformative work taking place in around the world. And I think this is extremely, extremely positive. So you have regressions and laws, but you have a very lovable, I'm looking for Anna, because Kyrgyzstan was a major place for struggle, and she was there. So, and it's not just the regular places, Latin America and Europe, it's really Thailand, Asia. You have a very lovable sex work movement now, and I think this should be looked with attention. Dilma Rousseff. Okay. Yes, there was a dimension of misogyny in the process that led to the impeachment. The fact that she was a woman has counted in the quite horrible campaign that the right wing and the anti-PT groups have made. But I don't think that this is the full explanation. Because the attacks on Lula himself, being shown in public demonstrations as an inmate of a prison, were also very, very mischievous. And there you had a class issue. It was not a gender issue. Yes, it's important to call attention to that, but I don't think that this is what explains what is happening in Brazil. It's much more complicated. I cannot go into details. But in reality, there were huge structural problems with the economic model that the PT has constructed for the country. In particular, it's bet on a certain model of development based on extractivism, commodities, agribusiness, oil, and a consumer market. It was a model that lacked entirely a consistent, solid rights perspective of universality. And this is, in part, what explained what happened. The other piece is corruption. Corruption is not a lie, it's not an invention of the right wing. It was a huge problem. And my last comment is that Dilma Rousseff as president is just one example, in my view, that electing women to positions of power does not ensure gender equality, and much less policies and laws in a perspective of sexualities and gender justices. Dilma Rousseff's policies on women's rights have been concentrated on gender-based violence, supported by criminal law approach. The last measure she has taken was the approval of a law on feminicide that increases penalties of homicide that are very high in Brazil already. And as you have seen, we have 60,000 homicides per year, which means that criminal law is not resolving the problem. And this legislation, supported by feminists from all quarters, was easily approved in Congress with the support even of the enemies of Dilma Rousseff, who are the evangelicals and the right-wing security, public security people, because they love criminal law. Huh? On the other hand, the retreats, reluctances, and regressions in relation to sexual orientation, gender identity, and particular abortion during the Rousseff administration are very, very regrettable. I mean, we had a regression in terms of abortion that is a shame. And so while recognizing that there's a problem of misogyny, on the other hand, I think we need to be very careful in creating a mythology around that, because very concretely, from the point of view of my agenda on gender and sexuality and human rights, the Rousseff administration had many, many, many caveats.
Yes, in the middle. Take another round of questions. I see.
Nick Douglas from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Thank you very much for an incredibly rich and nuanced talk. My head is still spinning a little, so I'll try and keep my question concise. I was really interested in the point that you made about the engagement of transgender activists with debates around the ICD-10, the International Classification of Diseases, and the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And one of the things I'm really interested in is about securing access to the biomedical services that that some transgender people absolutely essentially need. And my experience of this is that it's been a strategic engagement with those debates and with the controllers of those frameworks as a way of justifying and securing access, and also using human rights agendas in order to secure that access to healthcare. And many of us have found that kind of problematic, but have seen that as a way of strategically trying to secure those rights. And I think in your talk you wanted to sort of problematize that. And I wanted to ask you to just say a little bit more about that, and maybe if you had any thoughts about if that is a problematic strategic approach, and I agree to a large degree that it is, what might be a better set of alternatives? I wonder if you had any thoughts on that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else?
Hi, my name is Valentine, and my question also related to the rights of transgender people. I was thinking that there is a kind of paradox between, on one side, many, many changes that have occurred in Europe and all around the world in the last 20, 25 years, and the emergence of a lot of conservative leaders, especially in Europe. So I was wondering what you think is going to happen in the next few years.
There was a question, behind you first, and then, yeah.
Hello, I'm Lukas Schulz from the LSE in Media and Communication Department since today. And I want to. I'm very interested in the rise of the discourse on gender ideology among right-wing activists, and specifically at the transnational level, because it's becoming prominent in many different countries. And I'm wondering if you could tell us something more about the origins of this discourse, and maybe possibly also about its spread to different countries. And I'm also specifically thinking about the role of the Roman Catholic Church in that.
Yes, let me...
So I know I have seen other people's questions, but we'll just do another round afterwards. I think three is probably about right.
I'm going directly to you because I don't have a response. I think this is a response that needs to be constructed collectively. The regressions in politics around the world are very, very, very troubling and very worrying. And we have to name them, and we have to recognize they are happening, and we have to think and talk and envisage ways of resisting. My own prospect in relation to that is not very optimistic, I would say. I really agree with what the queer and feminist, North American queer and feminists have said, that we are moving into times of resistance. And we need to get prepared for that. Huh? This is not to say that we should abandon any form of institutional engagement, but to do that, it's depending on the mindset. I think that this field has been moved in the last 25 years within a mindset that institutions will deliver. States will deliver rights. The international system will deliver good norms, and these norms will transform the world. Huh? I don't think we should entirely abandon that space of interaction in institutions, but I think we need to engage with that with a much more sober position with respect to that. And most principally understand that is not enough, that you need to be elsewhere, screaming, protesting, and resisting. Yeah? And it's not an either-or situation. We need to do both, and people doing both need to be respected. Huh? It's not because you're doing institutional work, your work should be devalued. You're doing just street work or resistance. How to articulate those two modes of modalities of politics, I think it's a very critical challenge we have for politics in general and for this field in particular. With respect to your question, I'm not an entire specialist on the very difficult technical questions that are emerging in the discussion of ICD. I'm part of an advisory group of GATE, Global Action for Trans Equality, so I advise them on human rights language and some other procedures. What I understand, and you can go to the sites of the GATE site and the site of the Trans Depathologization Campaign, they have much more detailed information there. What I understand is that the problem of the requirement of the diagnostic to access health care is not as universal as it would seem to begin with. It's a peculiar problem of the U.S., the U.K., and other European countries. In other places, this does not apply. And I'm looking to Yana and Anna that are saying that. And so to define the problem of the ICD reform in terms of just those places where access to private health care required the diagnostic is to contaminate a discussion on normative violence with a very provincial perspective of northern countries. I understand that this is how Mauro Cabral and the other people, Morgan, the people dealing with the difficult struggle there are addressing the issue, saying, okay, we need to recognize the context of specific cities. Some places the diagnostics should be there because otherwise people would not access health care. This is acknowledged. But this cannot be the frame that is going to define how the whole transnational debate is going to evolve. Huh? But if you need additional information, I can decidedly put you in contact with the people that is working directly, more directly, with the nitty-gritties of that politics. It's responded, more or less. Yeah. I told just a kind of a microscopic story of that. Yes, the notion of gender ideology was invented in the Beijing conference by this representative deal from one of the U.S. right-wing. He had that brilliant idea when he read Anna Faust-Sterling paper, and we were heading to the Beijing conference, and they were all sitting in those corridors. I don't know if you know that. There's so much to tell about that. There was one of the Beijing, I think it was Beijing Plus Five, where the U.S. right brought friars, dressed as friars, to the UN corridors. And they were doing exorcism around the young lesbians. It was as horrendous as that. They would encircle young lesbians sitting together, and they do sessions of exorcism in UN corridors. It's as dramatic as that. You know, I don't know why we didn't have the technology at that point to document all those things. And that language was taken by this professor of the University of Navarra in Spain, which is an institution with strong links with the Opus Dei. This is recognized everywhere around the world. She's a theologian working at Navarra, and she published the first piece on the problem of gender ideology in Spanish in Costa Rica in 2000. And very quickly, this was captured by Ratzinger, then the head of the contemporary Inquisition in Rome. And he was then he became more powerful, and he began issuing letters for the bishop to the bishops attacking gender ideology. The first one was for the American bishops in 2002, and the second one for all the bishops around the world, saying that it was very positive that the notion of gender and the equality between women and men was put forward in the world because this was about justice. However, the notion that sex and gender is not natural was very problematic because it was fitting into an idea of polymorphous sexuality. This is the term that the document uses. That is very troubling because this is not how God wanted the world to be organized. Huh? This is not how it should be. There's an order of things, to quote Foucault. There's an order of things, how things should function. And this sexual polymorphy was troubling that order. And so they spend the rest of the book, or the document, just elaborating on the problem and why it's problematic. Gianni Vattimo, the Italian philosopher, that apparently has very close ties with the Vatican now, at that point in time, he wrote a very interesting piece about the way the Vatican was treating. This was already with Benedict. I mean, Ratzinger was already the Pope. And he said something that I think is worth reminding. He said that the appeal to the tradition of the church about the natural organization of gender orders that is the basis for the attack on homosexuality and gender identity and everything that we care for. Differently from what Ratzinger was saying, is not original to the Catholic tradition. It's entirely borrowed from Aristotle. It's the Aristotelian vision of the world transported to the church through St. Thomas Aquinas in the Middle Ages. which is the idea that that order, the gender order with procreation at its center, reproduces the divine order. This comes from Aristotelian thinking. It's not the tradition of the primitive church. So, and then it was in Rome. After it was in Rome, I mean, it's transnational, and the Catholic Church began spreading this all over the place through its incredible powers. I mean, we're dealing here with an amazingly powerful institution that controls media, that is grounded at the very ground level. It is having conversations with powers that be, that sits at the UN as a permanent observer. So when their mindset moved into gender ideology, they began just spreading and spreading and spreading. And it's now all over the place, and it's not just being deployed by the Catholics. It's also being deployed by the evangelicals. I mean, the evangelicals have entirely bought into that agenda in the U.S. and Latin America. In the case of Colombia, it's very interesting. The gender ideology attack that happened a month before the peace agreement referendum was supported by three forces, so to speak. The very conservative Opus Dei Catholic state actors sitting in the state apparatus, they have a very conservative general attorney, Ordóñez. Uribe, the ex-president, who is a very conservative Catholic, but secular. And the evangelicals were the ones at the ground level that have moved the agenda of the gender ideology. It was the pastors that were talking on TV, on YouTube. It's because in Spanish, but it's worth watching what they say. The discourse was, this is the pastors, we have to be against the peace agreement, first of all, because the peace agreement was dealt in Cuba. This is the beginning of the conversation. And he would say, well, this is about communism? No. Because Cuba is the place of the Afro-Cuban religion, Santeria. So they say it's because of Santeria, because this is the religion of the devil. Huh? So this agreement has been completed in the place where the religion that prevails is the devil's religion. In addition to that, that agreement has gender language, and gender language means all the horrible things that the evangelics says about homosexuality and etc. So it was a very incredible tropes in those discourses. But this were not the Catholics. This was the evangelics. But now it's entirely set, which allows for the new Pope, Bergoglio, to play games. Sometimes he's very nice, and sometimes he's very evil. He sometimes says that he said that gender was diabolic. He was the other one doing a connection between gender and the devil. There's a gender and the devil business spiraling going on here that I think we should be more attentive to. No, there's a middle-aged spirit coming back.
We're going to have to co-opt the language of witches again, I think.
Bonfires, yeah. Bonfires and witches, yeah, yeah.
Can I just see if there are a couple of brooms. Last questions that people would like to ask? I know there was a question.
Let's collect the brooms.
There was a question that I saw over there that somebody wanted to ask. Matthew and then Wendy, and then we'll need to stop in 4 minutes. So if you could keep your questions very short, please, that would be great. Thank you. There's one at the front first, and then it doesn't. Yeah. Hold on one mic.
Hi. In terms of gender identity laws, I was wondering about this very controversial thing that was debated in Chile, well, it still is, because of the gender identity law that has been discussed. It's about when, at what age, children should be deciding their gender, and it's still very controversial. Some people think this that we should have, like, from when you get 18 years old, and some of them things I know very little, but there's a lot of like legal discussions about that, especially about judgment and stuff. And I was wondering what would you recommend that we should do?
Yeah, Matthew Waits from University of Glasgow. I wondered if you would agree that one thing that follows from your argument is that NGOs have a particular responsibility to disaggregate their legal strategies for promoting human rights from their social strategies. And one of the central problems we've had has been, I mean, particularly in the area of queer politics, LGBT NGOs prioritizing legal strategies too much and having too little focus on the social strategies. And we see that embodied in organizations like the Human Dignity Trust and the way that mm-hmm. I think Stonewall in the UK has sort of not sufficiently got involved in the international, partly because there have been legal strategies going on which other organizations have been pursuing. So would you agree also that that responsibility is greater in the global north, you know, in light of global power relations? Mm-hmm. And how can we take that forward? And also in academia, would you agree that in the sort of academic wing of queer politics, also feminism, we also see the power of law as a discipline? And we have for example, in the summer I was in Amsterdam and you have Kees Valdic launching a new summer school on law and human rights. So we have a sort of legal wing of queer politics which is accentuating this legal focus. So how can we move to a more participatory focus?
Thank you. And Wendy, do you want to ask questions?
Thank you so much for your talk, Sonia. Wendy Sigal from the Gender Institute. I have a slightly half-baked question, but I can at least pose it precisely and maybe clarify it with you later. But I was struck when you were talking about people still using the language of rights and just sort of reflecting on current events. Human rights were developed because of a consensus about a problem that human rights were meant to solve. And I'm just not 100% sure that what's happening right now actually represents that we still have that consensus. In fact, it seems that that consensus is really dismantling. And if that is, how can we actually use rights language productively?
Thank you for those questions. We, I'm afraid you have about a minute and a half. But see how you do.
I can talk to you about, there's a new book coming by Laura Saldivia, who is looking exactly on the problem of children. The depolitization campaign in GATE, the main problem, as I said, in the process of the reform is the problem of gender incongruence in childhood. This is a question that connects with the bigger problem of consent. Huh? It's not just about gender identity developments. It's the more broad question of consent, and I'm looking to Matthew that has been working on the subject. There's a huge problem of consent that needs to be unpacked before you move into the higher complexities of the gender identity issue. I understand that the campaigners are calling for gender diversity and are saying that enabling spaces should be provided for children to be able to evolve and without constraints, without norms and rules, without any medical intervention until the moment where they feel they are ready for. I understand that this is the frame that the depolitization campaign is using, and this is why they are contesting the the retainment of the notion of gender in Congress in childhood, because it's still pathologizing children. And this implies that medical interventions would happen before when the person herself or himself is able to take a decision. But I can find additional information. I totally agree, Matthew. There's a problem with donors. I think it's much more the donors, I would say. The governability of rights, the problem of governability of rights has become a problem of the donors wanting, it's very neoliberal, huh? Is wanting outcomes, measurable outcomes. And measurable outcomes becomes laws being reformed. And with that, all the rest, which is the more important, is left out. Huh? And NGOs that have to survive, they have relied on those monies, and everybody's geared towards reform, and there's no resources. There's no resources. There are no resources for intersectional work these days. Huh? And there's no research for ground-level work. Huh? It's really a governability that has been determined by the political formation of the time. But this can be questioned. Huh? This needs to be interrogated. In ILGA conferences, in every conference where we go, this needs to be raised. And this is why I was so insistent about the question of dissent. I think that the political debates that happen around the creation of the post of the independent expert was very important, because people questioning the proposal was doing that on the basis of intersectionality. And this was sidelined, huh, by the main institutions involved, and I think this is not, it's not fair to the people that were dissenting, but this is not a problem of friendship, just. It's just because from a political point of view, it's very important that this dissent politic is there to make it alive. And there's an additional problem, Matthew. What is going to happen now with Trump? Will this work be sustained? I'm not so sure. The effects on funding, on what the donors... I'm not sure what is going to happen now. So everybody's going to get... somehow to be forced to get back to the streets, so to speak, or to the ground level, to beginning working again. So I think this is a topic for a more full discussion.
I think I'm afraid that we do need to stop, and I know that there's the question hanging in the air of whether there's a consensus that rights, of what it is that rights is responding to, but maybe leaving that question in the air is a good open question.
Yeah.
Can we thank Sonia once more, and please join us for a drink.